You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the show.
You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
What is that? All right. Let me start over. Hi, folks. Welcome to the show. You know, we've been doing some changes in software and changes in, a lot of stuff. You know about all that. And that's a little bug we've got to fix yet. All right, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful planet, thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. And those of you joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. Well, I tell you what, we had a great time last night with our Open Line Live and, you know, just some great comments and thoughts and observations by people. There's one thing, I was listening to the show. I don't often get to do that, but I did this time. And remember last night, there was one of the callers, he was, I think, from Arkansas, and he was saying he was nervous. And I said, well, just take a deep breath and don't worry about it. I don't bite. And he said, okay, and he hung up. I think he thought I said bye. I think he thought I was hanging up on him. So that's not the case. If you listen to the show, you'll hear I said, I don't bite, B-I-T-E. I want to say to that caller, if you thought I was hanging up on you, that's not correct, and we want you to call in, all right? Just calm, take a deep breath, talk to me like you would your best friend. I don't bite, B-I-T-E. You know about Jeff Woolline, right? Jeff Woolline is a researcher, investigator of ancient petroglyphs and their relationship to a lot of the strange phenomena that we see out here in the Phoenix area. he's going to be featured on the UFO Hunters tonight. If you miss it tonight, you can catch it tomorrow night at about midnight. And I think you will find it to be very, very interesting. So if you get a chance, you want to be sure that you tune in and watch that. Jeff's a great guy, and he has come up with more information that makes sense about those petroglyphs than anyone else I know in the area. In fact, anyone else I know. If you get a chance, tune in and watch UFO Hunters. And you'll get to see Jeff Woolline. You'll get to see some of the petroglyphs. They went out on South Mountain with him. And I think you'll find that very interesting. Well, let me ask you, where do you live? Think about it. Where do you live? Do you live in Phoenix? Do you live in Dallas? Do you live in Los Angeles? Yeah, well, maybe where we live is in some sort of a kind of a matrix. Have you ever given much thought to that? Well, we're going to be talking about that as a possibility tonight. My guest in just a couple of minutes is Jim Elvidge. And Jim is a person with quite an interesting and quite a high-tech background. And we're going to be talking with him about where do we live? Do we live where we think we do? We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said, my guest is Jim Elvidge. Jim is a bona fide leader in the world of high technology. He holds a master's degree in electrical engineering from Cornell University. He's also the holder of four patents in digital signal processing. He is the co-founder of Radio Amp, the first private label online streaming radio company. And he's the author of a book entitled The Universe Solved. Jim, welcome to the show. We're glad to have you.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Jim, let's just start out with the title of the book, The Universe Solved. Now, that's a pretty tall order.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. I have to admit, it doesn't solve everything in the universe, but There are a lot of what are called theories of everything these days. You know, there are theories that physicists put forth and other people in the metaphysical world. And this is sort of, it's kind of a theory of everything, but it's sort of on top of all those other theories of everything. So in other words, it explains all the other theories of everything. And I'm not, 100% convinced that what's in the book is really truly what's going on. However, there's an awful lot of evidence that supports it, and I'm the kind of person that tends to believe what is proven to them. And I'll say that this idea really does explain a lot of things and solves a lot of anomalies and a lot of problems that we've encountered.
All right, let's sort of give us a thumbnail of what we're going to encounter in this book.
Okay, sure. So people are probably pretty familiar with the movie The Matrix. There have been some other movies like that. The 13th Floor, Existence was one. Hollywood likes to explore the idea of alternative realities, places where you where you thought you were, but you're not really. The reality that you think you're in perhaps isn't the real reality. This has been explored a lot in science fiction and in the movie making business for quite a while. And basically, what the book does is it looks at a bunch of different categories of evidence that lend some credibility to that whole theory. I mean, if you think about it, there's no way to really tell that you're not dreaming or that you're not living in a manufactured, simulated reality. Those people in the Matrix, they had an implant in their brains and they were fed a stream of stimulation that made them think they were in a real world, but they weren't. There was no way for them to know the difference. And what I'm saying in the book is that there's actually quite a few different types of evidence that lend support to this idea that we may actually be living in, if not a matrix, but something that is driven somewhere by a large program. And so what the book will do is kind of explain the concept. It'll present all the different categories of evidence, and then it'll do a little bit of speculation about, who did it, when might it have been done, and the book gets into a lot of different things. It covers everything from physics and hallucinogens and anomalies, paranormal occurrences, nanotech, and surprisingly, they all sort of tie together and help to explain this idea.
All right, let's talk about some of the evidence that we may be living in, if not a matrix, a virtual world, a virtual reality. What's some of the evidence that that may in fact be the case?
Okay, well, one of the first things to do is to kind of get your mind wrapped around the idea that it's actually feasible. If you can do that, then all that has to happen is you have to think about how probable it is. So to think about how feasible it might be, I want to talk a little bit about Moore's Law and kind of the world of gaming and technology that's going on today.
All right.
You and your audience is probably very familiar with Moore's Law, which is something that says that every 2 years or every year and a half or so, technology basically doubles. And that pertains to a lot of different aspects of technology, like the speed of a microprocessor in a computer, the density of transistors on a chip, the resolution on your TV screen or your computer monitor. And, you know, if you go back to, say, 1980 when the game Pac-Man came out, I'm not sure if you're old enough to remember that one, but I certainly am.
Yeah.
There was no mistaking that game for anything real. It was a 64-pixel character. It ran on a 3-megahertz processor. It was, you know, 200 by 300 grid, you know, with these kind of pixelated bananas and fruit and ghosts floating around and everything. But today, if you walk into a Best Buy or your favorite electronic superstore and you take a look at what's on the screen, you might see a football game, and you very well might be confused as to whether that football game is a real football game or whether it's Madden NFL 09, because they've gotten to the point now where they can simulate reality extremely well with an 8-megabyte screen running on these teraflop, you know, PS3s that are a million times faster than the engines that drove some of the early video games back in the 80s. So we've certainly gotten to the point where we're, at a glance, we're fooled visually into thinking, you know, hey, I'm at a football game, or I'm seeing a football game, and it's really not. We can also easily be fooled, you know, in the terms of the senses of our of sound, of hearing. It's pretty much impossible to tell, you know, a babbling brook, the sound of a babbling brook from one that's, you know, in a nice sound system on nice headphones in your ears. So from the standpoint of visual perception and oral perception, we're almost to the point where we can fool people, and it's really just a matter of time when we're able to really stimulate the senses completely to the point where what you perceive is indistinguishable from your reality, from what we see today. So the feasibility argument goes like this. If that's possible in 15 or 20 years, which is what everybody is saying, and given the state of the art now in brain-computer interface, the things, the kinds of experiments that are going on that artificially stimulate the brain, artificially read processes in the brain, you know, it's at the beginning of that technology. But if you think, you know, here's where we are now, here's what Moore's Law says about how fast we're going, in 15 or 20 years we'll be at the point where it's indistinguishable from reality, how do we know we're not already there now? So that's really the feasibility argument. And if you can kind of accept that there's really nothing to prove that you're not living in the reality you think you are, then it's a matter of probabilities, and that's where all of the evidence in the book comes into play.
All right. I would think that self-awareness would play a big role in our being able to determine whether we are surrounded by reality or if we're surrounded by a virtual world. For instance, you've seen on television the animations where it's a hybrid animation, and you have real people being filmed interacting with animated characters, and our eyes can visually see the difference between a real human actor and the animated actor. Okay, now I would think that I would be able to tell whether I was in a virtual world or if I was in a real world, whatever that means, by means of self-awareness. I can see me and the difference, qualitative differences between me and what is being generated. But I think what you're getting at is if I myself am being generated by a program somewhere, then I would not be able to tell that. Is that true?
No, not really. You know, my feeling is that we are self-aware, that we do have free will, and there is an entity out there that is, you know, thinking through these things. But imagine yourself completely surrounded by a full alternative sensory experience where what you're looking at looks so real to you that you can't tell. You reach out and touch it, and it feels real. And I'll give you an example. Imagine that, you know, the way your senses work, your sense of touch, your sense of taste, your sense of sight, all of that goes through nerves that enter your brain. And your brain then processes the signals that it gets from your eyes and your ears and your fingertips and whatever sensory organs you have. So there's a part of your brain that has to do the processing of what it sees. Now imagine that if in your brain there was a device that basically intercepted all of the sensory signals coming in and then passed them on to the processing part of your brain, you wouldn't know that device was there, right? That would be pretty transparent to you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now imagine that device then, instead of passing it directly onto your brain, it sends it to a remote computer, and the remote computer instead just basically passes it through back to your brain. So now it's being read by a remote computer. All of your sensory experiences is being interpreted, but nothing's happening, and you're still feeling the same thing. And as long as that remote computer isn't so far away that the speed of light that it takes the signals to get there and come back doesn't, you know, get violated and you don't perceive a delay, you would have no idea that this is going on. Well, now let's say that this remote computer receives the signals and decides to play a little trick on you. So you're standing in front of a mirror, you look at yourself in a mirror, and the remote computer says, aha, he's standing in front of a mirror, he's looking at himself, I'm getting these sensory signals. I'm going to replace the image that he's perceiving of himself with an image of a chimpanzee, and it sends that back to your brain. Now your brain is looking in the mirror and it sees a chimpanzee, and you move one way and the chimp moves, and you move the other way and the chimp moves, and you lift your fingers up to feel your face, and you feel fur because that's what this remote computer has done. It has basically taken your reality and modified it. So pretty soon you're going to think you're a chimp, especially if this is all you've ever known. You know, if you were born with this thing in your head, you would never know the difference, would you?
Well, I think that's true. You know, I was just thinking about matter as related to Pac-Man. Pac-Man doesn't exist except as pixels generated by a program, and then those pixels put up on a monitor that lights up in the frequencies that our eyes can see. But Pac-Man doesn't actually exist. And in that sense, in sort of that same sense, things that we think are solid matter, for instance, a solid wall, it's not solid. There's more space in what we call a solid wall. There's more space than there is matter. The space between all of the molecules, and then the space between the atoms that make up the molecules. There's more space than there is solid matter. But we perceive it as solid. And, you know, I've read a number of papers, I've read a number of interviews with people where they said, you know, it might be possible someday for us to generate, because of technology, generate a some type of field around us that enables us to pass through the space that we think is solid. Now, I mean, that's a little mind-blowing, but at the same time, it's easy for me to visualize. Just as Pac-Man doesn't actually exist, in a way, the wall doesn't exist. The wall is made up of pixels, if you will. It's made up of atoms, but there's more space there than there are atoms. And so, you know, that sort of bends our perception then of what's real. I mean, it's real. You can't, if you run headlong into it, you're going to get bruised. But you know, still at a level of physics, there really is more space there than there is solid matter.
You're absolutely right, and there's a few different directions we can go on that discussion, but I'm glad you brought that up because it is true. And if you get right down to it, what is it that makes that wall feel hard? It's not the stuff itself. It's the electromagnetic force. It's the fact that when the molecules in your fingers get close to the molecules in that wall, they repel each other. And they repel each other because they're sufficiently packed together. But in between those molecules, there is so much space. It's kind of like it's kind of like being in outer space. You know, the stars are very far apart, and there's a lot of space in between them. But they generate so much gravitational field, it's hard not to feel the effects of that gravitational field. a couple of interesting things about what you brought up. Some physicists have recently done some experiments, and these are really kind of mind-blowing experiments. It's a team in Vienna has been doing some experiments that people used to think these kind of things couldn't be done. You couldn't make these kinds of tests, but they have now, technology has allowed them to dream up experiments and tests that can validate these kinds of things. And what they're testing out is some basic tenets of quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics is one of these, you're probably familiar with it. It's a theory of physics that was developed through the 20th century. And basically it says some kind of interesting things that are kind of counterintuitive. One of them is that reality might not be real until you actually observe it. And this is the thing that these physicists in Vienna were trying to determine. There's another aspect of quantum mechanics called locality, which says that there are some cases where you can take two particles and so-called entangle them, so they get involved with each other in a way. They feel each other's fields, and then you separate them. You can separate them by light years. You put one on the other side of the galaxy, and what you observe one particle to do, somebody on the other side of the galaxy will observe the other particle to do, and you can't force them to do anything different. So it's almost like they're in lockstep. They seem to know each other, and yet physics tells us that they can't be communicating because the speed of light doesn't allow that instantaneous communication between the two particles. These physicists are trying to determine which is wrong about quantum mechanics and which is right. Is it this idea of locality or this idea that reality doesn't exist? And what they determined, to a huge factor, like 80 orders of magnitude, is that reality doesn't exist until you observe it. It's the old, if a tree falls in the woods, does anybody hear it? It's the same concept. And they've made, they've tested their results and made some kind of conclusive, papers on this, that basically reality isn't physical hard stuff. It's something that isn't real until you observe it. And if you think about it, maybe that wall that feels so hard, when you get right down to it, what is it composed of? It might just be composed of information that describes all of the particles in the wall. It describes where they are. It describes, how strong their field is and all those kinds of things.
Okay, but let me ask a question then. How would, if reality doesn't exist until we observe it, and there are two of us standing on the road, on the side of the road, and a bright yellow Mack truck comes by, how is it that both of us observed a bright yellow Mack truck? Now, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to get into that. All right, folks, we'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Jim Elvidge is my guest this evening. Jim, what about the question I asked? Two of us standing on the side of the road. If reality doesn't happen until we observe it, two of us standing there, and a big object comes by, and we both see a bright yellow Mack truck. How is it that we both perceived the same reality?
Well, you've both observed it. So I guess your question is probably, you know, why would you perceive the same thing as the other person if this is sort of all under program control, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's a good question. As an example, I'd use a video game. If you're familiar with World of Warcraft or EverQuest or those kinds of things. The people who play those games, they have a representation of themselves in the game called an avatar. So each avatar actually sees the same thing because the construct of the game is not part of their control. You know, it was built by the programmers. So each avatar in the same place will see the same thing around them. However, the interesting thing about that, and so might it be with our reality, that each person who is, you know, in control of their being in, you know, in what we perceive of as reality, sees the exact same thing, but that same thing is under program control. But the interesting thing here is that in the computer game, you could play around with that a little bit. You could say, well, a certain number of people are going to, we're going to allow them to see something that other people can't. I think you probably know where I'm leading here. Imagine that a UFO or a Bigfoot or some sort of paranormal, illusion came into the field of somebody's vision. They're darn sure that they've seen it. The other person, or maybe somebody clear across town who theoretically should have been able to see the same thing in the sky, didn't see it. Or maybe a whole lot of people saw the same thing, but not quite everybody. I mean, this is what has happened in the UFO phenomenon, that some people see them, some people don't. They disappear, they come in and out of people's field of vision. You've heard all of the stories about this.
Yeah, but they are measurable with radar. They're measurable by being picked up on infrared cameras. Whether someone sees them or not, they're still measurable as having been there.
Sure, and all of that can be under programmed control. So it's possible, you know, how, for example, could it be possible for something to disappear? You're staring at it and it suddenly disappears. Well, one way is that it could be programmed to do that. So, you know, imagine again back in the world of a World of Warcraft type of game, if I wanted to make the game interesting by putting some anomalous occurrences in the game, I could very easily program that kind of thing. I could program things to violate what we thought were the laws of physics, we being the avatars in the game. I could have it move so fast that, you know, it would be barely possible to see it, or I could have it so that only certain people could see it at certain times of the night and in certain regions of the country.
All right. So then what we have is what you're describing is the possibility that we may be living on the holodeck.
Effectively, yeah. Exactly.
One of the interesting things about the holodeck, and of course I'm referring to the holodeck used by, that you used to see it on Star Trek, and they'd go to the holodeck and tell the computer, okay, I want to be in 17th century England, and it would generate what appeared to be real all around them, and it was not just a hologram. It actually, they could touch it, they could set in the furniture. And so we many times when we think about holograms, we think about light, that these are projections of light. But it may be possible, we're only getting to the point, you see, where we can do realistic-looking holograms with light. But it may be possible at some point in the future where we could project not just light, but atoms to assume, and the electromagnetic fields, so that those atoms would assume the shapes and colors of real material.
Absolutely. And what you're describing is something called a utility fog. It was actually a concept that I think it was J. Storrs Hall came up with it some time ago. And, you know, basically the idea is this. You have a number of nanobots. Nanobots are these, you know, microscopic, even smaller than microscopic, devices that you can't see an individual one. So imagine something, you know, 1,000 times smaller than a grain of sand. You can't see it, but it's able to fly. It's able to link up with other ones. It's able to generate light in different colors, and it's able to move. And it's able to be all completely networked to, you know, other versions of itself, be it via a, you know, wireless computer network of some sort. This idea, called a utility fog, is something that's really very feasible this century. We are developing micro-robotic flying devices. Last year, I think Harvard University had one that was 3 centimeters, and that, too, is following Moore's law. The year before, it was 6 centimeters in diameter, and it's under remote program control, and eventually they're going to get these things so small that you can't see them. Well, if you have that, if you imagine having a swarm of millions or billions of these nanobots, they can do anything. They could turn into a road, and you can drive on the road. They could turn into a room. Maybe you're sitting in a living room watching television, and you press the button, and all of your nanobots reform into the bedroom, and you go to bed. All these ideas have already been explored, and they're all technically feasible. I mean, there's a certain number of years away. Some people are putting these nanoswarms and utility fogs maybe 50, 60 years away. But that is exactly what you're talking about. That's the physical reality under programmed control kind of scenario, which is different. It's more like the holodeck. It's different from the Matrix in the movie The Matrix, which is generated by stimulating your brain. This other one is actually, you know, physical manifestation of reality under program control. Different concept, but certainly could follow the same rules and the same kind of programmatic laws.
Have you ever seen a movie called Dark City?
I did, and that was an interesting one too. I don't remember too much about it, but I remember this was, you know, at midnight, everybody fell asleep, and they, you know, they recreated reality, or they modified reality.
Oh, yeah, the skyscrapers disappeared, the city skyline changed, and then when they woke up in the morning, they also had had their memories changed. They remembered a life. They remembered parents. They remembered brothers and sisters. And, you know, and they had a whole new family around them, but they didn't know that. And when they woke up in the morning, they were just waking up to what seemed normal to them. And then some guy figured it out that it just wasn't real. And as it turns out, this dark city actually turns out to be sort of a massive spacecraft. It's out there in space by itself. What if...
I remember that. Now I remember that ending.
Mm-hmm. Now, what if our entire planet is someone's nanobot experience? Or maybe it's not yet an experience. Maybe it's an experiment. And maybe everything on this planet is going through the changes it goes through because they're reconfiguring the nanobots.
Yeah, absolutely possible. I mean, you know, a lot of these ideas, they sound really far-fetched at first, but then the more you think about them, the more you realize there's no way to really tell, and we're really not that far away from, you know, generating those kinds of ideas ourselves, the way technology is going. For example, this idea of, you know, waking up to a different reality or thinking, you know, having a different family or whatever, that's related pretty closely to a lot of research that's being done in all the medical schools around the country on brain-computer interface. So they've done some experiments where they can, for example, generate a grid of light in your visual cortex, so blind people theoretically can see. And these implants have been implemented at this point. But, you know, basically they're stimulating your visual cortex with this grid of signals so that you think you can see. So you put a bunch of little CCD cameras on glasses, for example, and you walk around, and those just transmit this, you know, into this device that's implanted into your brain. Memory control, they've figured out, although the brain, memories in the brain are distributed throughout the brain, kind of like a hologram, they still have been able to trigger certain memories by stimulating certain parts of the brain, and they found that they can eradicate certain memories through chemicals or through electrical stimulation as well. So, again, it's a technology that's sort of at its infancy now, but in some years, you can imagine that it wouldn't be, you know, unfeasible for somebody to wipe out a certain set of memories and download a different set. In fact, the transhumanist movement thinks that that's going to happen in 30, 40 years, that will all be possible, that you can upload your memory bank somewhere, store it off, download it, maybe download a, you know, a different one and play out a different life for a while and then upload that or whatever. You know, they think this is all possible this century.
I the whole transhumanist thing to me sounds rather ominous. And the reason is because of what you've just described. The reason is that once we start doing that, there will be no definition whatsoever for who are you really.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I actually have a kind of a different view on how this is going to work than the transhumanists. I don't think it's going to happen. And part of the reason that I suspect that it won't happen is because software is not moving at Moore's Law. To get artificial intelligence, you have to have sufficiently advanced software. And they've been talking about smart robots for years and years and years. And, you know, basically we haven't gone as far as we've moved in terms of, you know, density of transistors on a chip and those kinds of things. Software technology really hasn't increased that much. Just as an example, I found a study where they compared how long it took to boot up Word on your computer back in the 90s and the early 2000s and today. It was actually faster back then.
Jim, we have to take a break. You're right. Computers have gotten slower. All right, folks, we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And to my guest, Jim Elvidge. Jim, when we cut away for break, you were saying that they did a study on, I think you said, Microsoft Word, and just comparing how long did it take to boot it up, computers several years ago and the operating systems then and today, and it actually was faster in the past. And I think that is something that many of us have experienced. You know, every time there is an upgrade, every time there is, you know, the newest, latest, greatest whiz-bang operating system comes out, it is, in my opinion, a nightmare. And it's not because I'm not computer savvy. I am.
Oh, I totally agree with you, Kevin. I think that a lot of what's driving this, of course, is the need to sell more product. You know, if you were satisfied with what you had on your desk and all the software that was installed with it, then those companies would eventually go out of business because they would have nothing else to sell. They'd have to come up with whole new programs. It's a lot easier for them to upgrade existing ones and put in little paperclip wizards and, you know, things like that that you don't necessarily need. And, you know, I've been in the software industry my entire life, and I see what goes on. It's, you know, the software has gotten more and more bloated. People buy, you know, gigabyte development environments that, you know, add these massive libraries to the executables, and they don't even need half of what's in there. And, you know, that just kind of bogs everything down. So, you know, the argument that we're going to get to the, you know, point in that the transhumanists say, you know, AI will happen so quickly and that we'll merge with AI and those kinds of things, you know, they've got to fight this software bloating effect because software is not advancing as fast as hardware is. And the other thing that's happening is as the world moves faster and as this accelerated pace, you know, continues to go forward, we are just actually unable to keep up with it. I mean, we can only handle so many interrupts a day and so many, you know, new things. And at some point, the singularity, which predicts a, you know, exponential rise in the pace of technology, I think what's going to slow it down is just the pure fact that we can't assimilate it all. And
there are limits to our own CPUs, aren't there?
In the time frame, they say.
There are limits to our own CPUs.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right, now, let me ask you this. If we're living assuming that we are living in a reality that has been generated as if by some gigantic computer code, who is the programmer? Who is the architect? You said earlier you think there is an entity that's running all of this. Tell us about that.
Yeah, no, to be honest, I don't explore that too much in the book. I mean, I certainly, you know, we put together the possible scenarios that it could be an Earth company in the future, so it could be us in the future, and that we're just playing a simulation in our past. And I actually think that's kind of unlikely that we would be sort of, you know, playing out a simulation that talks about the same technology that we have to get past in, you know, a couple hundred years, because I just don't see the motivation of playing a simulation in your past for as long as we seem to be doing it. But it could be an AI, or it could be some biological, you know, life form from somewhere else. And, you know, any of these things are possible. And I think the biological life form from somewhere else is probably the most likely case, if indeed we are living in a programmed reality. But again, I think, you know, the evidence is real strong there. And one of the examples of the kind of evidence that I think really show that this is possible is what I call the finely tuned universe. And you're probably familiar with some of this as well, that universal constants, according to physicists, they cancel out vacuum energy in the universe to an accuracy of one part in one followed by 115 zeros. And there are so many perfectly tuned things that make it impossible for us, almost impossible for us to exist, if it weren't for the fact that it's just so perfectly tuned. That's an amazing thing. And you know, some people, the creationists, will say, well, there's a God behind it. And that's sort of the same kind of argument that I'm making, except that I'm saying it's programmed. And other people, the scientists, will say, well, it's this anthropic principle. There's really zillions and zillions of parallel universes that follow different laws, and, you know, where you're in one, you're doing one thing, and in another, you're doing something else because of a different decision you made. And, you know, with all of that out there, the only one that we could be in that would make sense is the one that we're in. And it's sort of a circular argument, and to me, it's very complex to say that, you know, first of all, to accept the idea that there are uncountably huge number of parallel universes out there, and then, you know, this idea that, you know, the one that you're in is the only one that can support life and you know, happen to be, you know, have all the right constants, the right physical constants for stars to even form, let alone life.
All right, well, I want to go back to what you said, though, about the God concept. And first, this is your first time on the show, so you probably do not know this about me. I am not a religious person. Having said that, I'm also not stupid. And, you know, I look at concepts and compare concepts. And, you know, one of the things that's pretty interesting here about the possibility of, okay, God's doing it, or, as you said, a programmer. One of the interesting things is there's really not, conceptually, there's no conflict there. The Christians carry a Bible, and in that Bible are these words, that all things were created by His Word and are held together by His Word. Okay. What does a programmer do? A programmer writes in a language and instructs the computer in a language. And so that the program are His words. The program is His words to the computer.
I like that.
So, conceptually, there's really not any conflict there. If there is God, I would not see that there is a problem with saying that, okay, then He has programmed all of this, and that's what it means when it says by the power of His Word. He wrote out the instructions, and it's being carried out.
Right. I'm right with you, Kevin. You know, I'm not a religious guy either. I consider myself to be, you know, somewhat spiritual in that I tend to believe there's something beyond the earthly existence. Don't know why, just feel it. You know, I've experienced things or known people who have experienced things that sort of lend some credibility to that idea. But, you know, I think, you know, the idea of, you know, what is a God? I always think of it as a God with a capital G versus a God with a small g. God with a small g could be the programmer. You know, whoever created this, if it was an AI or an ET, then those are, by definition, our gods, because those are our creators, the creators of our world. The God with a capital G is more the one of the religions, the various religions. And I always think of that God as sort of more of an analog guy, you know what I mean? You know, this, you know, just because of the, you know, the way it's portrayed in various religions, there's no programmatic concept to it. This is more of a technology thing, the programmed idea.
But I'll tell you something. I'm going to use pun intended here. Honest to God, there's a big conflict between what we're talking about and religion. There's not a conflict between what we're talking about and what's actually written in the Bible. But that, of course, then implies that I'm saying that there's a huge conflict between the Bible and religion, and that's exactly, precisely what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I have no problem with that. I've actually read the Bible cover to cover just because I was curious, and I'm a guy who just loves history, and I found it to be, you know, fascinating with a lot of, you know, great lessons in there and great history and, you know, quite a bit to it. But it's not at all what the religion ended up being. But that being said, I think there are some big differences between the sort of, you know, analog God creating everything, sort of winding up the clock and letting it go, and this idea of a, you know, a reality behind which there's some sort of, you know, programmatic device.
All right, now I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
All right, the programmer writes the... I got caught by the break. All right, I'll get to this question when we come back, all right?
Okay,
folks,
sure.
We have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. We are back, and this is the Kevin Smith Show. I am the Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is Jim Elvidge. Jim is, he's got a master's degree in electrical engineering from Cornell University. He holds 4 patents in digital signal processing, and he's the co-founder of Radio Amp. All right, now for the question. Let's assume that your theory is 100% correct and that there is a programmer somewhere that wrote the program that's generating what we are perceiving as reality. So far, does that describe the theory?
Yes, sure.
Okay. Let's assume that. What happens if the program has to be rebooted?
great question. Well, you know, assuming that we are, you know, what I'm proposing that we might be, which is we're an entity somewhere and we're projecting into this programmed reality, then the reboot would consist of replacing our memories and rebuilding the universe. So that sounds like a pretty large task, and it is, but it's not as big as it actually sounds.
So we would continue to exist.
Restoring the memories, again, is something that, you know, the same kind of thing that transhumanists talk about, and while I don't believe that that's going to happen in the year 2045, I do believe it is within the realm of technology, and, you know, if you take into account that maybe it's 100 or 200 years out, that's just minute in terms of the lifetime of the universe. So it's very likely that there are other civilizations way beyond that and could have that technology. But I digress a little bit there. So then the other thing that has to happen is you have to recreate the whole scenario, recreate your universe. And
then we're starting all over again.
Yeah, and again, it's sort of up to the programmer. They could theoretically reboot a different version of it, and you'd never be the wiser because you would think you would have all the same memories that are self-consistent with everybody else's memories about reality number 2 or whatever, you know, the next version is called.
Okay, now, this would explain, I'm not saying that it does explain, but it could explain why we find evidence of very ancient very ancient, in the, going back millions of years, high-tech civilizations that existed.
Right. That is certainly one explanation of it. I've had maybe a slightly different point of view on that, but I like your idea better.
Well, it's just a, you know, I'm just throwing ideas out. I had not thought of this in those terms prior to the show, but you know, we find things that cannot be explained by our status quo archaeological explanations. And they are things that indicate that someone had very high technology. There are things that we find that we would have extreme difficulty in reproducing today, and yet there they are.
Let me throw out a different idea that's kind of related to that, and I think might lend some credibility to that whole idea, which is the similarity with video game patches. When a video game comes out, let's say you have one of these, again, one of the massively multiplayer online role-playing games, an EverQuest or a World of Warcraft, and everything has a certain resolution. You know, the trees look a little bit coarse, and there are a certain set of monsters or whatever, and there's a certain set of artifacts that you can discover. And after a while, people get kind of bored with that. You know, they're tired of fighting the same old monsters. They're tired of seeing the same old scenery. They need something new. They need something different. They need some stimulation. So what do the video game programmers do? They put in a patch, and it's a real-time patch. The game never has to come down. It's just every time, the next time that the person logs into the game, they get a little download in their client, and now all of a sudden everything looks a little bit different. Oh, hey, there's another island over here, or, you know, we've got some more higher resolution trees or something like that. So, you know, theoretically, this could be what goes on. We get bored with our life. We get bored with society as it is. So there has to be something interesting, something keeping us researching and keeping us, moving forward. And one of the things might be the deliberate placement of ancient artifacts that fly in the face of archaeology. And maybe there is a completely different archaeology out there that we will admit to someday. But maybe also these are just things that are just going to keep people employed and keep people interested and keep people talking and writing blogs about, because that's sort of what it's all about.
All right, so let me ask this. If things are as you have surmised, as you have speculated in your book, are we then the characters in someone's video game?
Well, I think that we are the ones playing those characters. You know, again, if this is true, we would be the ones playing the character.
In other words, I'm sitting here in the studio in front of the microphone, and I'm actually just an avatar.
Right. Yeah, very, very consistent with everything in the book. I mean, I think that's more or less it. The word game is, you know, I guess I'd question whether or not that's the right way to portray it. Is it a simulation or is it a game? Is it, you know, a game kind of implies that it's for fun or that it's a, you know, a lighthearted experience as opposed to, say, you know, an educational thing. So, you know, some people have speculated that life is all about education. It's about advancing your soul or developing values. And other people speculate that it's just a game. It's something to play out, and you play out a different game after you die. But all of those are consistent with the idea.
All right. Tell you what I want to do. I'm going to open up the telephone lines. And the telephone number, ladies and gentlemen, is 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. 539-9580. For those of you watching on our internet television feed, it's on your screen. And we invite you to call if you have a question or a comment. This is some pretty heady stuff, some pretty heavy stuff as well. But, man, I like it because it's the opportunity to expand our minds and to think about other possibilities. Now, you said you're not absolutely certain that things are as you describe them.
No, I can't be, really. You know, one of the things that I do in the very beginning of the book is, you know, put forth sort of a thought experiment, which is, you know, how do you know what's really true? Can you really know anything for certain? So, you know, for example, you know, how do you know you didn't dream something? If you have a different recollection of something in the past than your friend or your wife, one of you is wrong, and so you really can't know for sure that that's true. You know, how do you know that the stuff in front of you that you're feeling is really what it is? How do you know you're not being fooled into thinking that? You know, we've shown that that's even possible, too. And so when you get down to it, there's almost nothing that you can know for certain. You can't trust your memories. You can't trust what you see and feel. And I know that can be a disturbing concept for people who like to feel grounded and like to feel like, you know, there are answers. Personally, I don't have a problem with everything being kind of a shade of gray that way. I'm not 100% believer in this idea. I still hold out the possibility that it is, you know, what we all think it is. But again, you know, the evidence just kind of leans me the other way. And I've asked myself the question a million times, if I've written a book and I've looked at all of this evidence, and, you know, the evidence we haven't even touched about has to do with quantum mechanics, and it has to do with, you know, theories of logic and all kinds of things. You know, if all that evidence is just sort of overwhelmingly supporting this idea, why do I still hold on to the possibility that it isn't real? And it's just because, you know, that's how I was brought up. That's what everybody else thinks. That's what we're all used to. And it's really hard to, you know, to get away from that. And I don't believe anything 100%. I tend to see, you know, the dark side, the light side, the good, the bad, and, you know, all possibilities. I'll say that I give it a 95% chance that this is the case, but that's probably as far as I'd go.
All right, so is the game that we're playing, and I know I'm using that in the very broadest sense of the word. I know that that's not the word that you would choose to use. But the roles that we're playing, the game that we're playing, is the fact that this is being this is a programmed reality. Does that make it all deterministic?
I don't think so. It could, but I think the deterministic part of it, or the non-deterministic part of it, has to do again with free will. You know, I do believe that we are conscious entities out there somewhere. And actually, this differs a little from the transhumanists, too, who believe that you can take a hunk of silicon and make it sufficiently advanced and it becomes as conscious as we are. I just don't buy it. I think there's something special about life forms that, and I'm not saying just humans, but animals, too, that give us free will and therefore make things a little bit non-deterministic. Maybe not a lot non-deterministic, because we are, you know, what we do is the product of our influences and our environment and our sensory stimuli and our memories. But, you know, I think there's a little bit of non-determinism in there driven by people's free will.
How much of what you are talking about do you think someone in the federal government, some agency, or maybe some part of the military, how much of it do you think they have considered and are aware of?
Well, like they say, whatever you are aware of in the non-black ops world, you can assume that in the black ops world, it's about 10 years advanced. So, you know, I got to think that a lot of this has been considered. A lot of the sensory stimuli ideas have certainly been considered by people in those think tanks as well.
All right, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? All right, Charles, just one moment. We're having difficulty with your volume. Let's get you up. All right, Charles in Albuquerque, what's on your mind this evening?
Well, I've been listening to the show here, and I'm afraid I've had to sharpen up my Occam's razor.
Well, all right, let's go with Occam's razor. What's on your mind?
Well, it seems to me that at least in the explanation of things like UFOs being able to appear and disappear and things like that, that it's just not necessary to hypothesize the existence of some holographic universe and control over all of our existences by some unseen force to explain that. It's much simpler to just assume that there's some law of physics we don't know about.
All right. What do you say about that, Jim?
Oh, yeah, no, I think, I completely respect his point of view there, and I think that, I just picked one example. The interesting thing is that if you pick every single anomalous example, like another one might be the fact that if you're familiar with the Princeton Research Group, the PEAR eggs, the Paranormal Research Group, that, why does global consciousness tend to make random numbers non-random? Why are there particles in the world of physics called anomalons, which have different properties in different laboratories? There are anomalies in science and metaphysics. There's thousands of them. And all I'm saying is that this one theory can actually explain all of them. But if you only look at one particular anomaly, like the UFO phenomenon, yeah, it might make more sense that it's actually a physical device. That Occam's razor might say that tends to be the more simple explanation, but that explanation isn't going to explain all of the others. This one explanation explains everything. And since you did bring up Occam's razor, I would put out there the question about the scientific point of view, which is, again, that zillions of parallel universes are spawned every fraction of a second, and that through this anthropic principle or some wacky ideas like Flexi laws, the laws of physics evolve, that we happen to be in this finely tuned universe. Which makes more sense, that or just the fact that it was programmed for our existence?
All right, I'm going to throw this out for both of you. I don't buy that the laws of physics are a fact. And the reason I don't is because we have seen over the past couple of hundred years those laws of physics that we thought were laws changed. They actually didn't change. Our understanding of how things work changed. There were, first, you have like Newton's laws of motion. That was the absolute bedrock of physics. And then this little guy comes along named Albert Einstein with a general theory of relativity and a special theory of relativity. And they chuckled at him. They laughed at him. He was a nobody. He was, But now today, what he wrote is accepted as being bedrock laws of physics. So I think that what people refer to as the laws of physics are not laws at all. They are simply descriptions of our current understanding of the way things work, and I think they are completely inadequate. They got us to where we are. They will take us no further. We have to understand the way things work in a different way, or we have to understand in a different way the way things actually are working. Now, you may agree with that, you may disagree with that, but Charles, I'm going to throw that to you first. What do you think?
Well, let me respond by saying this. Have you ever been to a movie and been watching the movie there and been absorbed in it, and then suddenly you noticed on the screen some defect on the screen? and suddenly instead of watching the movie, you were watching the screen.
Yeah.
I think that what our guest is talking about is sort of like watching the screen of the movie of life.
Yeah, that's
suddenly
a good
he's
analogy.
Seen the defect,
mm-hmm.
has perceived that, like the Hindus believe, life is but an illusion. He realizes that we're immersed in the Maya, the illusion of life.
What do you say, Jim?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. In fact, a lot of the shamanistic cultures around the world have very similar beliefs about reality. And, you know, not to get too much into the, you know, sort of artificial stimulus method, there are some studies using DMT and some other chemicals that have allowed people to effectively what they call lifting the veil, where suddenly they're perceiving a different reality. These kind of experiences are also similar with people who have had some brain injuries. So it almost seems like the brain is keeping us focused on the movie and not on the screen. And yet we have the capacity to look at the screen. We have the capacity to maybe experience the true reality. It's just that it's all filtered out. So and if it weren't filtered out, then, you know, what's the point of being in this reality? So whether it's because, you know, it avoids confusion or because it, you know, achieves the end result of the programmers, I don't know. You know, those are hard questions to answer. We don't really have enough, evidence to kind of lean one way or the other. But I do like the direction you're going there, Kevin, with the fact that, you know, physical laws aren't really laws. They are approximations. Newton's laws were approximations at slow speeds and large scales. And Einstein's laws took into account high speeds, and quantum mechanics took into account low scales. But those two conflict until they came up with loop quantum gravity and so on and so forth. And it seems like we're always going to be digging deeper and trying to find the truth. When do we dig so deep that we actually hit reality, you know, is the interesting question.
Charles, thanks for the call, man. Deep thoughts. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, thanks for being there as usual.
All right, thank you. All right, folks, the telephone line is open, 602-539-9580. Yeah, I don't think that the laws of physics are laws. I don't think so. And I had Dr. Michio Kaku on the show, and I said the same thing to him. And I said, what do you think? Do you buy that or not? And he said, oh, absolutely. And I said, look, you know, someday some really smart guy is going to, or gal, is going to come up with something that steps right over the boundaries of what we think are the laws of physics. And we will have a whole new understanding of what are the, quote, laws of physics. But the laws of physics have taken us where they can. The laws as we understand them, they have taken us where they can. They have shown us the limits of themselves. A good example of that is, what's the speed of light? Approximately 186,000 miles per second. This is viewed as the fastest anything could ever possibly travel. Nonsense. The very fact you talked about the quantum theory of locality. So we have a particle here and a particle there, and they instantaneously, without any difference in their in time, they respond at the same time to being observed.
Exactly. I don't know if you're familiar with a book by Julian Barber called The End of Time. It's an interesting book, and he basically takes the theory of quantum mechanics sort of to its ultimate conclusion, which is that that the world is just a sequence of states. And time is going between those different states. So if you think of, you know, this state is, you know, if you were able to freeze this state and then one quantum jiffy away, you freeze that state, well, all those states can be described with information, and all we're doing is stepping through those different states one chunk at a time, and that chunk is actually, it's a known quantity, it's 10 to the minus 43rd seconds. That is what quantum physicists tell us is the discrete nature of time.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll pick up there when we come back. Telephone line is open, folks, 602-539-9580. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Jim Elvidge, and we're talking about some pretty brainy stuff, kind of mind-bending stuff. Now, let's really bend some minds here. You mentioned a moment ago, Jim, that through various means, some of those means are chemical. There are other ways. People talk about, in shamanistic cultures especially, having the veil lifted, and they can see other realms and other realities and so forth. Now, here is a question that I have related to that. Let's say there are zillions of parallel universes, as you say, being born every nanosecond. Okay, the veil is lifted, and I can see the reality. I can see what's really going on in this other parallel universe or whatever. I don't live there. I live here. And so whatever I view there has absolutely no associative value here. Wouldn't that be true?
Yeah, I would say so. I think that the idea of the ever interpretation of quantum mechanics with the zillions of parallel universes, it probably conflicts with the idea of programmed reality. And I think the programmed reality is more consistent with this lifting the veil concept than the quantum mechanical view.
Okay, well, let's go with programmed reality. Let's say that it's all true, and that I, living here now, sitting at this microphone, am actually just an avatar, and that the real me is somewhere else conducting this game or playing my part in it. Let's say that that's the case. So what?
Yeah, I mean, good question. That's probably the ultimate question. You know, so what? What's the point? What's behind it all? I have absolutely no idea. I mean, you know, we've talked about some things like the training ideas, or, you know, maybe just to develop your values or something like that. Those are ideas that are consistent with sort of New Age concepts, sort of Edgar Cayce's view on things, and actually some of the shamanistic's view on things. So, you know, I begin to wonder, you know, are all these things tied together a little bit? You know, did Edgar Cayce, was he given by the programmers a little bit of lucidity into what real reality is like and, you know, how things work? I can certainly imagine the possibility of parallel realities. I mean, as easily as you can imagine different instances of EverQuest running on different servers. You only play on one server. If you were to jump over to another server, you'd have to have a different account. Well, imagine that somebody figures out a way to wormhole from one server to the other on the same account. You know, then all of a sudden now you've jumped over to a parallel reality. You know, maybe a similar kind of thing can happen with us, and maybe the shamans have figured out how to do it.
All right. Now, if it's all true that this is a programmed reality, the reason I said so what is that the fact is I, as the avatar Kevin Smith, have to deal with this reality, and I have to live in it, and it still happens to me as if it were all real, as opposed to being generated by a programmed reality. And so I still have to deal with it all, right?
Right. And the question is, are you dealing with it by choice or not by choice?
Mm-hmm.
One scenario might be that you have chosen to experience this reality. You know, you're at some point in the future, or you've perhaps done the brain upload download and experienced a different reality by choice, because that's what you wanted to do for whatever reason. Or it could be not by choice. It could be that, you know, we're all forced to play this out, and because there's some ultimate objective to the world, and maybe the ultimate objective is, you know, reaching nirvana or meeting God or, you know, striving to be the best we can be or dying with the most money. I don't know.
Okay, so then choice would actually be an illusion.
The choice that you feel in this reality is an illusion, yeah, in that sense.
So then free will would be an illusion.
Right, but does your entity have free will? So, you know, again, think about a dream. During a dream state, are you in control of your dream? Typically not. Typically it kind of runs its own course. However, people who are able to lucid dream, who have, you know, learned how to hone that skill, they're able to actually control their dream. So, you know, I think it's that kind of analogy. You might feel you're in control, but you still have the ability to, you know, to make decisions within your programmed reality. However, you're stuck in this reality, so you don't have unlimited control. I can't just jump out whenever I want, but I can decide whether to turn right or left when I walk out the front door.
Have you seen the movie Lawnmower Man?
Was that a Tim Burton movie?
I think so. You have a guy that is very physically challenged and somewhat mentally challenged, and they do some brain implants and basically do this transhumanist thing where his brain is running a virtual reality world, and you can jack in or you can jack out of this world. And it's sort of like what you're talking about, where you make the choice to jack in, but once you do, you're there, and you have to deal with what's there.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, then you have to deal with what is there.
Right. I don't think I have seen that movie, but I could imagine that kind of scenario where, again, the mystics often say that when you die, you have a spirit guide that helps you develop your next life. And, you know, I always wonder, well, why would I choose a life of poverty, or why would I choose a life where I'm, you know, blown up in a war? Well, maybe because I learned something that way. And, you know, when you hit the spiritual realm, you aren't thinking about the physical consequences or the physical feelings or those kinds of things. You're thinking about, you know, what am I improving, and what what values do I increase in this next reality? So, yeah, you know, you may have made a conscious choice to play in this game or to be in this reality, and with the understanding that you have to suffer through it until it's over.
Your book basically then is dealing with the question of origins. Is that correct?
I'd say it's dealing with whether or not there is a programmatic nature to it all. In other words, you know, there are ideas of alternate realities that don't have anything to do with a programmatic nature. The programmatic nature does imply that there's another entity that has created the reality for us. And I think that distinction is what the book's all about. It's, you know, what is the evidence that there's a programmatic nature to our reality? And again, I've got four or five categories of evidence. One is all quantum mechanical. One is from the field of logic. One is the fine-tuned universe, and one is the anomaly argument. So, and there are actually more. I think the similarities with some of what the shamanistic teachings are, it might be considered a fifth category as well, the lifting the veil idea.
Okay. What does this do to things like the Big Bang Theory?
Well, the Big Bang Theory, it is in our reality, isn't it? So if, you know, again, if this is true, then all the physical laws that we know and all of what we, you know, think has happened is just illusory. This program could have started 5 minutes ago. It could have started 5 years ago, or it could have started 10,000 years ago. It didn't have to start 13.8 billion years ago.
So then, in that case, I would remember 55 years that I was not actually here.
Again, that's one of these things that is definitely likely to happen in our future, that we are able to replace memories at some point. That's just a technology argument, and when is it going to be possible? So I think that, you know, given that the technology through nanotechnology and brain-computer interface, that we're at the infancy of it. It will be there in some period of time. Some people say 20 years. Some people say 50. Some say more. You know, given that that will happen, you have to accept that it could have already happened, and therefore what you think of as history is just implanted in your head.
Wow.
The big question that a lot of people tend to have is, well, how can I remember something, you know, if reality really started more recently than my age, how can I really remember something when I was young and my friend remembers the same thing and my parents remember the same thing? And again, that's just a matter of scale. That's just a matter of ensuring that all of those other entities that are playing the game have the self-consistent memories.
That's just like when you log into a game for your first time and it gives you the script that is, you know, the basic storyline.
Right.
Everybody gets the same basic storyline. I start playing today. You started playing 6 months ago. But we get the same storyline. So we have the same basic history of the game.
That could be, too. I do explore the idea that we have different timelines, that maybe we overlap each other's reality, which is another possibility. And here's another thing to throw out there. What of all of the other people in the world and in your life? Are they all necessarily avatars driven by a conscious entity, or are they programs like Agent Smith?
All right. We are we're coming up on a break. You just brought up something that we'll have to discuss when we come back from the break, because we won't have time here. But in the later versions of Star Trek, you had, for instance, Commander Data, and then you had something else, the Doctor. Now, the Doctor was completely a hologram. He looked like a person. He talked and walked like a person, but he was totally computer-generated. I want to get into those two possibilities when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on Final Approach, and that means, of course, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to get this call in, so I'll suspend asking my question. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Good evening, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
How are we doing?
Good.
I got a question. I don't know if it was virtual reality with Lloyd Bridges, where he was put into a virtual reality. Is that right? You know what I'm talking about, that movie?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
And also you said Matrix. Well, in both those movies, the code comes, like in Lloyd Bridges' one, where he was put into a virtual reality, that the programs that were no longer needed were deleted, but they had a life of their own, so they would move themselves. They wouldn't go to the delete part of the computer. They would go and hide in a smaller part of the computer because it had its own, they created its own life, the belief of life, and didn't want to die. Same thing with Matrix, where on the one with the Keymaster, he was a program, but yet he turned around and helped. He was a program inside the program that was supposed to be working for the program, but yet he turned around and helped the people that was in the program. So I was wondering if your guests speculate on if you have such a machine can give people that much free reality to create their own reality, in that the machine itself would sooner or later become smarter than the person that made it.
Okay.
And I'll take the answer offline.
Thanks for the call. Well, what about that, Jim? What about parts of the program developing self-determination?
Yeah, it's a real good question. I think that that's one of the concerns that people have about artificial intelligence, that once it gets to the point where it exceeds the capability of humans, then it could just suddenly take over. It would assimilate knowledge so quickly and kind of leave us in the dust. I would have to think that somebody who is programming something like this, that is a more of a simulation that has autonomous programs in it, would be intelligent enough to realize how to put sort of fail-safe mechanisms in there. One thing that just springs to mind is in a multitasking operating system, you can assign a certain level of sort of slice of the bandwidth of the computer to any given task. You can maximize that. So in that sense, you could, you know, theoretically put some limits on some autonomous agent in the program to prevent it from getting too powerful or taking over too
well,
much.
Well, in keeping with what you just said, there are people who have talked about the incredible non-use of our brain power and, the very best, the top geniuses in the world, they estimate are using only something like 10% of their brain power. And I've heard it said that it seems as if someone has installed a firewall in our brains. We can go so far, and then that's it.
Oh, well, that's a really interesting idea. I hadn't even thought of that before. I've always disagreed with the whole concept that we only use 10 or 20% of our brain. I mean, you know, if evolution is right, why would we evolve to have a brain that's mostly unused? It just doesn't make sense. But what does make sense is that there is a background process, like you say, a firewall or something like that, that's performing some functions that we just don't understand right now. Maybe we're, you know, those processes are attached to the real reality and receiving instructions receiving updates or something like that. I had the thought at one point that maybe when you sleep is when you get updated. Maybe that's the purpose of sleep, you know, so that you get the, you know, the patches and the things like that that allow you to keep going.
It seems pretty interesting that there seems to be a pre-written code that says when you reach a certain number of years, it's over. You know, I mean, there's an average number of years. I think the maximum anywhere in the world is about an average for males is about 78 years maximum. Of course, there are exceptions to that, but it seems to be kind of hardwired into us that when we hit that, it's over.
Yeah, no, I think that's a real good point, because if you look at it mathematically, like, everything falls into bell curves of probability. And if the bell curve of life expectancy is 78 with a standard deviation of, I don't know, 10 or 20 or something like that, then you would expect there to be a long tail. There's going to be a few people that live past 115, but nobody lives past 115. That's like the hard cutoff. And why is that? Maybe it just has to do with the fact that we have to recycle, that this, you can only play out the program or the reality so long, and it doesn't make sense to do it any longer. But it's definitely, I think, an anomaly, that hard cutoff in human age.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing thing. I mean, it seems that we can do things that will dramatically decrease the number of years. Obviously, you know, a heavy drinker, a heavy smoker, someone who overeats all the time and is obese, someone that never exercises, obviously can cut down the number of years. But there doesn't seem to be a tremendous amount that we can do that dramatically increases the number of years.
No, there isn't. We can push the average up, but we can't seem to get that maximum up, can we?
That's right. And that's similar to having played all levels of the game. Game over.
Yep, maybe that's it.
Wow. All right, look, we've only got a couple of minutes left. Where can folks get your book?
Oh, sure. The best place to get it is the website, which is theuniversesolved.com, just as it sounds. On that site, you can... I've got a lot of things on the site. There's a forum, there's a blog, there's an interesting Powers of 10 where you can explore programmed realities at different levels. You know, lots more papers and things to think about, and there's an active community of people who contribute to the site. But you can buy the book there, and I'll sign the copies for people who buy the book. You can also buy it on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. There are some book chains, especially on the West Coast, that sell it as well. So quite a few places, and you can find all of those links on the site, or you can just Google it, or go to Amazon and type in my last name or The Universe Solved.
And your last name is spelled ELVIDGE, is that correct?
That is correct, and you're one of the few people who get it right first time.
This has been fascinating. It's been I think it has been fascinating. I'm not sure if it has been or if that's been programmed into me. But I'm sensing that it's been fascinating. And it's a real mind bender and a mind expander. And I think, you know, whether one buys into this theory or not, it's well worth thinking about. There are a lot of mysteries about us that this theory addresses. And in the confines or within the parameters of the theory, answers. But there are a lot of anomalies about us. I often say, Jim, on this show, that the weirdest thing on this planet is us. And I think
that's
true.
A great way of putting it.
All right, folks, we've reached the end of the show. Jim, stay on the line with me for a moment. Thanks for being with us. It's been fascinating. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until tomorrow, so long, everybody.